thank you very much, David, for setting the bar so high. The mere television journalist in science, that's pretty good. I hope I can live up to it. Can everybody hear me? Okay, so I'm all set. All right, so I am going to talk to you a little bit today about what we do and show some clips if I can make this work. Okay, hang on for 1 second so I can get ahead of the game. Okay, so I'm delighted to be here today talking to you about NOVA. There's a lot to say and to show in very limited time, so I've decided to use this talk to give you a basic introduction to our series, what we do, why we do it, and how. NOVA is currently in its 39th season, and that's an eternity in television. It's longer than Seinfeld, I Love Lucy, and Friends. Although General Hospital still has a few years on us. No, I was really super worried about whether you guys would get these popular culture illusions. But now I see you're my people. This is great. Okay.
I've never seen them,
but
heard of them.
Well, or you don't want to admit it. But anyway, but longevity is a mixed blessing in television. So like Jack Benny, NOVA will never reach 40. It will just keep going on at 39 forever. NOVA is the only documentary series on American television dedicated to telling important science stories week in and week out about 49 weeks a year. We make about 20 new shows each year, and we're supported by corporate funders, foundations, individuals, PBS, and viewers like you. Thank you. NOVA began in 1973, started by a visionary named Michael Ambrosino. At that time, broadcasting in the United States had virtually no science programs, and most broadcasters believed that science would not sell. But Michael knew that the BBC had many highly successful science shows in its lineup, and he went to the UK to study how. He came back convinced that the BBC experience could be repeated here, and he began NOVA based on the BBC series Horizon. And, as they say, the rest is history. Now, since Michael began NOVA and hired me, the television industry has totally changed. The advent of cable and satellite television has created 400 channels instead of 4. But one thing has not changed. It's all about ratings. While Discovery and the National Geographic Channel, our main competitors, have made some distinguished science programs through the year and still do occasionally, in general, they have joined their cable brethren in a race to the bottom with cheap reality programming focused on males 18 to 49 that shows men engaged in such manly behavior as shooting alligators in swamps, chopping down trees, driving on icy roads, searching for gold, jousting, and preparing for the end of civilization. Focus is just as weird. Extreme couponing. Hoarders, including people who hoard dead animals. And my personal favorite, Toddlers and Tiaras, a series focusing on mothers who enter their young daughters in beauty pageants beginning at age 2 or 3. So you can imagine my shock one evening as I was preparing to go to dinner in Los Angeles with the TV on, hearing Anderson Cooper on his CNN Ridiculous comparing Toddlers and Tiaras to NOVA. Just as jaw-dropping, he said, but without all that pesky science. Now, you'll forgive me if I say all this with a bit of glee, because it showcases the distinctive nature of PBS and NOVA. Alone among American broadcasters, we aim not only to be entertaining, but educational. To do either of those alone just isn't that difficult. Research tells us that topic is the most important determination of rating success. So to achieve high ratings, all we'd have to do is focus on perennial favorites, what I call weather porn, or other topics in a category that I refer referred to by the acronym TRSH, or Transparent Rating Seeking Hype. But we have an educational mission and a commitment to genuine science content. So by way of introduction, let me play you our mission reel so you can get a sense of the scope of what we do. Now, I apologize in advance for the promotional nature of this reel. It's what we use to attract funders, so please feel free to leave a check at the door.
1957, the Soviet Union beat us into space by launching a satellite known as Sputnik. And that was a wake-up call that caused the United States to boost our investment in innovation, particularly in math and science. 50 years later, our generation's Sputnik moment is back. This is our moment.
Never been a more important time to showcase science, technology, and engineering. In 2009, more than half of all U.S. patents went to foreign companies. even with high unemployment, manufacturing jobs, returning to the U.S. for the first time in decades, are going unfilled because American workers lack the education to handle the technology. Last year, I visited Crenshaw High School in Los Angeles and sat in on an experimental class where students were taught to create computer games as a way of engaging them in math. The task was to compute how far they had to move a little stick figure a third of the way across a screen of 360 pixels. And a majority of the class, sophomores and juniors in high school, couldn't solve the problem. I saw firsthand the reason why the World Economic Forum ranks the U.S. 52nd in the quality of mathematics and science education. Only 18% of students in the U.S. receive undergraduate degrees in the natural sciences or engineering, contrasting with 47% in China, 38% in South Korea, and 27% in France. And in engineering alone, it's even less, with only 4% of U.S. undergraduates earning undergraduate engineering degrees. Clearly, no television program can solve that problem. But we contribute in a few ways. First, by helping teachers. NOVA has, for many years, been the most used video resource in science, high school science classrooms around the country. NOVA Teachers, the educational portion of our website, offers over 400 NOVA clips, activities, and lesson plans. And we're the number one provider of video resources to PBS Learning Media, a library of online educational tools, which is free and used by more than 500,000 teachers in 70% of the nation's public schools. But our goal is to go beyond students to reach the general public with a positive message about science, scientists, and the scientific process. At a time when science is under threat from both the right and the left, when the present level of funding for scientific research is in doubt, science literacy is more important than ever. And yet, more than 40% of Americans don't know how long it takes for Earth to orbit the sun, and 48% don't believe in evolution, the foundation of all biology and medicine. Another 40% believe that human beings and dinosaurs lived at the same time. Those were the people who spent too much time watching the Flintstones. At NOVA, we consider it the core of our mission to inspire people in a way that helps them become more engaged in science, to turn them on to the pleasure of finding things out, as Richard Feynman put it. Our goal is to create programs that are a blend of education and entertainment to give our viewers something smart and something fun at the same time. One viewer wrote that NOVA is living proof that turning your brain on at the end of the day is actually more rejuvenating than turning it off. So how do we make these shows so that they're both educational and entertaining? Priority number one, very simple, tell a good story. Our ideas come from a variety of sources, our own research team, independent producers, scientists, the mainstream press, and science journals. But topics don't make stories. We're looking for ones that have a natural storyline, a mystery to be overcome, a mission to be accomplished, an obstacle to be overcome. Those are the ingredients of any good story, and a science story is no different. So let me show you one of my favorites. We called it Smartest Machine on Earth, and it's about IBM's recent effort to create a computer program to win at Jeopardy. First, let's take a look at the prologue that summarizes the story.
The stage is set for a showdown the world will be watching. All eyes will be on one competitor, but he's not breaking the sweat. We're not talking nerves of steel, more like a rock-solid member of silicon.
My name is Watson.
For the first time in history, a computer will compete in the ultimate brain game. For the scientists who created Watson, the excitement and tension are palpable.
It's going to be edge of your seat. It's going to be nerve-wracking.
A four-year odyssey.
But
comes down to this.
What the deal is going to happen? You just don't know. You don't know.
There are more than reputations at stake. Some say a Watson victory could signal a new age, a revolution in artificial intelligence.
It used to be the case that intelligence was chess. Like, you can play chess. That's intelligence.
But taking on spoken language and ferocious wordplay means engaging by a whole new set of rules. It requires more than just memory to match wits with humans.
That's it. But understanding the question is a pretty big deal.
How will Watson do it? Nova gets unique access to the making of Watson, shadowing the IBM team working around the clock, training and test driving Watson.
Watson, what is the pink pen?
And we put the right rules for every combination of word and phrases and context, refining powerful new tools of computing. It's a huge job for machine learning. You're like, whoa!
Watson, what is man?
Yes, we got it. And creating a machine that can learn from its mistakes.
What is mosquito?
No.
Holiday?
No.
Artificial. Sweet. You can get them all now.
No.
You don't understand the question. I don't understand what. We don't understand a category.
That was one of the tensest days I've ever had.
You fall flat on your face, but I expect you to fire. No, but maybe. We came back, and the game was neck and neck.
Wordsworth said they soar, but never roam. Watson?
What is Skylark?
That's correct.
Is Watson ready to face the game's all-time champions?
This is too daunting a task for a computer.
I think we've gone from impressed to blown away.
When man takes on machine, who will win?
Watson!
What is it?
Yes!
Nova takes you inside the world of artificial intelligence and the quest to build a computer like none before.
Good luck, Watson.
Smartest machine on Earth, right now, on Nova.
Now, I'm going to show you in this next clip how we actually honed in on the scientific challenge that these computer scientists faced.
At IBM, as Dave Ferrucci and his team tackle the Jeopardy challenge, we know that facts and rules are just the beginning. We couldn't write rules for every combination of word and phrases and context. They need a new system, more fluid and flexible, to navigate the twists and turns of many different kinds of Jeopardy questions. They named their system Watson, after IBM founder Thomas Watson. The electronic Watson consists of 2,800 processors. That's like 6,000 high-end home computers. Altogether, it's the size of 10 refrigerators. The team starts filling his memory banks with about 10 million documents, most downloaded from the internet. Because when Watson plays Jeopardy, he must stand alone, just like his human competitors.
All kinds of content, okay, encyclopedias, dictionaries, thesauri, books, plays, you name it.
The entire World Book Encyclopedia, Wikipedia, the Internet Movie Database, much of the New York Times archive, and the Bible are just some of Watson's resources. And to build on Watson's foundation of data and rules, the team turns to a powerful tool in the computing world. It's called machine learning.
Machine learning is just like human learning from examples. Before, people would just write rules by hand. Nowadays, it's all based on examples.
To understand how machine learning works, consider for a moment the letter A. What if you had to describe it to a computer? It's a real problem faced by the U.S. Postal Service, whose computers must decipher all kinds of addresses, printed and handwritten.
I know when I see it, but there's just way too many different types of A's. There are fonts where the A is just a triangle pointing up. That's an A. Realize there is no simple set of rules that you can write down currently for a program to determine whether a letter is an A or not.
Humans might not be able to come up with the rules that reliably identify all kinds of A's, but it turns out a computer can do it for itself if you give it enough examples.
The way you do it is you just get an A, send it to the program, and say, that's an A. Here's another A, different one, that's an A.
here's another A, it's a different one, that's an A. Then you would give it another example, and you would give it another example, and you would do that a million times.
The computer hunts for patterns among all those examples, and it finds them. So the next time it meets a letter A, even one it hasn't seen before, it will recognize it. This is machine learning, and it's a crucial element of Watson's programming. The team trains Watson. But here, instead of letters, the examples are tens of thousands of old Jeopardy questions, along with a cheat sheet of all the correct answers. Using machine learning, Watson will hunt for patterns between the type of question, the correct answer, and the kinds of evidence that support that answer.
And we did this over thousands of questions, so we come up with some way to weigh the evidence on average so we come up with the right answer.
Now, when he's faced with a brand new question, Watson uses what he learned from his pattern and declares his confidence in each possible answer.
In the end, we get a list that says, here's the top answer, and we're 75% sure it's right.
Watson has now become a complex architecture of rules, raw data, and machine learning that enables him to use statistics to choose the right answer. To test out the system, the team scours the halls for IBM employees who can play Jeopardy. And everyone squeezes into a conference room.
In 1978, New Jersey Monthly reporter Stephen Levy famously found this man's brain. Watson.
Einstein's.
Albert Einstein's, yes. The Fifth Amendment says that private property shall not be taken for public use without this. Watson.
What is just compensation?
Yes.
With this new system, Watson surges into the winner's club. We took a huge jump with machine learning.
Watson with a commanding lead, 24,863.
We saw a huge jump in performance, and we were like, woo! Up to now, appearing on the TV show has only been a dream. But Watson is performing so well, Lee Ferrucci decides it's time to call Jeremy.
He saw my name on that envelope about 20 times. And guess who made us use just staff members, the lawyers. Nemesis, bane of my existence. So priority one is story. Priority two, kind of obvious for a television program, is finding or creating awe-inspiring visuals. Audiences want to see beautiful pictures and get a perspective that they can't get anywhere else. So we try to show them the world from a different point of view through computer graphics and the amazing new tools of scientific visualization. So let's take a look at a segment from a recent program that we made called Hunting the Elements. And in this sequence, our host, this was one of the few Novas that's actually hosted, New York Times personal technology columnist David Pogue visits a lab at Cornell University where he's stunned to learn that he can actually see atoms.
And now for the moment of truth. Will this bell be good enough to sing? What time is it? Time to celebrate the millennia-old tradition of bronze. Our bell resonates with a beautiful tone, and it takes many seconds for the note to die out, thanks to the interplay between copper and tin. Even the best bell makers can't know whether their bronze will be too stiff or too soft until they pour a bell and strike it. I wonder, though, if there's a more scientific way to evaluate the metal. To find out, I'm taking a piece of it to David Muller at Cornell University. He's offered to show me how the atoms of bronze stack up. Literally.
All right. I brought you a couple of hunks of bronze, one of which was knocked off a bell when it was done, and one of which is unpoured. And I wouldn't mind taking a look at these under your magic microscope.
Okay, now, this is actually a lot of material. I need an area about the size of a farm, and you're giving me the whole of the United States. So we're going to cut it down a little bit. Now watch out, it's hot.
It's what?
Ow!
The mule gives the bronze a mirror-like finish. Then the sample is inserted into a powerful electron microscope. David tells me that when we reach full magnification, you will have images of the actual atoms in the bronze. Something few people have ever seen. Frankly, it seems a little far-fetched.
So what's in there right now? What are we looking at?
So we have a piece of the bronze that we cut earlier, very similar to this one.
Now, I have to say, this microscope is not especially impressive. I mean, I'm seeing the entire circle, but I'm just wearing a pair of reading glasses or something.
So this is like having a map in the United States, mm-hmm. and eventually we want to zoom in, and we want to pick out one car parked somewhere in the U.S.
We'll have to zoom in 100 billion times to see an atom. To understand the scale, imagine if I were floating in space 2,000 miles above the Earth, looking down at the United States. Zooming in 100 million times would allow me to pick out not just a car, but a bug crawling in the grass next to it.
So we can zoom in from here?
Absolutely. So there's the zoom button.
Wait, I see a little tiny cartoon sign that says, "Welcome to Whoville."
To see atoms, we need to find an interesting region to sample.
Now it's starting to look like an alien surface rock.
Well, now what you're actually starting to see is the microstructure of the grains in that bronze. And the brighter colors are things that contain more tin. And the things with less tin are the things that are slightly darker.
Oh my gosh, this is so cool.
The microscopic structure of metals is not uniform. Small features called grains become visible. Boundaries between grains are actually defects in the orderly arrangement of the atoms.
So you can't see atoms with this microscope.
We can get almost all the way there, but not quite.
Okay.
And to look at atoms, we're going to need a bigger machine.
Do you have one?
We certainly do.
A huge thing? This is a giant room-sized thing in a shipping container? And why is it draped in shipping crate material?
Those are acoustic blankets. They are meant to absorb and reflect sound because the microscope itself is so sensitive that if you were to talk, just the pressure wave from your voice is going to give enough mechanical vibration to shake this thing around. You only have to shake things by an atom for the energy dash.
So our little piece of bronze that we dug out of the first machine is now a little black disc here.
Well, that's the 3 millimeter support disc. The actual bronze chip itself is about 100 thickness of a human hair. It's too small for us to see, so we have to mount it on a carrier grid so we can handle it.
Oh, so you've essentially put it on a little plate.
That's right.
Are you telling me that I can see individual atoms of my piece of bell?
That's correct.
Scientists have understood since the early 20th century that metals are crystals. That is, they have an orderly arrangement of atoms. By bombarding samples with X-rays, they were able to create shadowy images of that crystal structure. But the idea that we might one day see actual atoms was beyond imagination. If David's microscope is powerful enough, we should see regular rows of copper atoms with tin atoms packed in between. Or so the theory predicts.
The dots are atoms?
That's right. Each individual dot is an atom.
We are seeing actual atoms on my little bell piece?
The bright ones, those are the tin atoms. And the slightly darker ones, those are the copper atoms.
And isn't it kind of like a mind blower that we're actually looking at actual atoms?
To actually see atoms. Amazing.
Well, what can we learn about this? Like for one thing, it is they're really, really grid-like. They're like a little aerial photo of a planned community.
That's actually the stacking of the atoms in the material. The pattern that it orders into, that is the crystal structure directly.
David tells me we got very lucky. The atoms in our bronze are unusually well-ordered. Our bell makers must be true masters of their craft.
Well, thanks for my tour into the unseen of what used to be the purely theoretical. I can't believe I can now put on my resume that I've seen atoms. Thanks for the tour.
It was a pleasure.
So I have to tell you that in the edit room, we were saying the same thing. Are you kidding me? The language wasn't that nice. Actually seeing atoms, it was really, I have to say, like, for me, wonderful moment. It was just wonderful. So I really understood David's enthusiasm. That's why he's such a good host, because he lets it all hang out. So now I want to show you what we can do with actual computer graphics. These are the centerpiece for our recent physics series, The Fabric of the Cosmos, hosted by Brian Greene. The series consisted of programs on time, space, quantum mechanics, and the multiverse. And what Brian wanted to do in both Fabric and in The Elegant Universe, our earlier series on string theory, was to create visual metaphors. So the scene that I'm going to show you now came from the third show in the Fabric series called The Quantum Leap. And in this scene, Brian visits the Quantum Club, a place where the rules of quantum mechanics are scaled up to the level of our big world. Now, this was a process that was extremely complicated to execute. So before shooting, the scene is planned out in hand-drawn storyboards. I'm going to show you how. The voice that you'll hear on this is that of the producer, Julia Court.
We don't notice the bizarreness of the tiny quantum world in everyday life. But if you could visit a place where objects in the larger everyday world behave the way quantum particles do, you'd be in for quite a show. For example, in the quantum world, things don't like to be tied down to just one location or just one path. One object might pass right through another. I might make my shot. But there's also a chance the ball will end up any number of places. And this may be the strangest thing of all. If people behave like the particles inside the atom, then most of the time, you wouldn't know exactly where they were. Instead, they could be almost anywhere.
So after that, the editor, the producer, and the animator worked together to create 3D computer-generated animatics as a way of planning out the actual shots that we're going to execute in the studio.
We don't notice the bizarreness of the tiny quantum world in everyday life. But if you could visit a place where objects in the larger everyday world behave the way quantum particles do, you'd be in for quite a show. And what I do here could have a direct effect somewhere else.
So finally, this involved shooting each shot over and over again with small variations in a green screen studio with Brian and actors. Am I blocking you here? We'll see Brian in just a minute. There he is. It's really very difficult to do this in an empty studio. Then all these different layers will be matched precisely. You can see the marks on the wall that help us do that, and married together. And eventually the green screen will be replaced with a virtual environment, and multiple animated special effects will be added. If you think it's tedious to watch, you should see how tedious it is to do. And now I'm going to show you the finished sequence.
We don't notice the strangeness of quantum mechanics in everyday life, but it's always there. If you know where to look, you just have to change your perspective and get down to the tiniest of scales, to the level of atoms and the particles inside them. Down at the quantum level, the laws that govern this tiny realm appear completely different from the familiar laws that govern big, everyday objects. And once you catch a glimpse of them, you never look at the world in quite the same way. It's almost impossible to picture how weird things can get down the smallest of scales. But what if you could visit a place place like this, where the quantum laws were obvious, where people and objects behaved like tiny atoms and particles. You'd be in for quite a show. Here, objects do things that seem crazy. I mean, in the quantum world, there's a sense in which things don't like to be tied down to just one location, or to follow just one path. It's almost as if things were in more than one place at a time. And what I do here can have an immediate effect somewhere else, even if there's no one there. And here's one of the strangest things that happened. If people behave like the particles inside the atom, then most of the time, you wouldn't know exactly where they were. Instead, they could be almost anywhere until you look for them. Hey, I'm gonna have what he's having. So, why do we believe these bizarre laws? Well, for over 75 years, we've been using them to make predictions for how atoms and particles should behave. And in experiment after experiment, the quantum laws have always been right. It's the best theory we have.
There are literally billions of tests.
I've passed so many tests. Well, so many bizarre predictions.
There's no disagreement between quantum mechanics and any experiment that's ever been done.
The quantum laws become most obvious when you get down to tiny scales like atoms. But consider this. I'm made of atoms. So are you. So is everything else we see in the world around us. So it must be the case that these weird quantum laws are not just telling us about small things. They're telling us about reality.
We estimate it took about 300 to 400 animator man hours to generate that one scene.
Wow.
Should ask our financial people. They'll tell you just what a wow it was. So along with story and visuals, a key priority is selecting great characters. In my experience, most scientists and engineers are actually very passionate about their work. Many of them are natural communicators, but some aren't. And when they're not, we work with them to avoid jargon and to speak in a way that everyone, not just their scientific colleagues, can understand. One of my favorite novas ever was about a Princeton mathematician named Andrew Wiles. Andrew Wiles was far from a natural communicator. He was a shy and reserved man, and it took a lot of work and talent to get him to tell the story of his 7-year odyssey to fulfill his childhood dream of proving Fermat's last theorem. The director of this film had to decide whether to put the math front and center or the character, and he decided on the latter. I showed this film to my science communications class here at UCSB, and some of the students felt that the fact that they couldn't follow the math ruined the experience for them, but others were completely drawn in by the character. So this is the last clip, and let's take a look at the setup of the story.
Perhaps I could best describe my experience of doing mathematics in terms of entering a dark mansion. One goes into the first room, and it's dark, pitch dark, and stumbles around, bumping into the furniture. And gradually you learn where each piece of furniture is. And finally, after 6 months or so, you find the light switch, you turn it on, and suddenly it's all illuminated. You can see exactly where you were. At the beginning of September, I was sitting here at this desk, when suddenly, totally unexpectedly, I had this incredible revelation. it was the most important moment of my working life. Nothing I ever do again will.
For 7 years, Princeton professor Andrew Wiles worked in complete secrecy, trying to solve the world's greatest mathematical problem. This obsession, which began when he was a child, would later bring him both fame and regret.
So I came for this. I was a 10-year-old. And one day I happened to be looking in my local public library, and I found a book on math. And it told a bit about the history of this problem, that someone had resolved this problem 300 years ago. But no one had ever seen the proof. No one knew if there was a proof. And people ever since have looked for the proof. And here's a problem that I, a 10-year-old, could understand, but none of the great mathematicians in the past has been able to resolve. And from that moment, of course, I just tried to solve it myself. It was such a challenge, such a beautiful problem. This problem was Fermat's last theorem.
Fermat was, by profession, a lawyer. He was counselor to the Parliament, to Leibniz and Krauss. But of course, that's not what he's really remembered for. What he's really remembered for is his mathematics.
Pierre de Fermat was a 17th century French mathematician who made some of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of numbers. His inspiration came from studying the arithmetica, an ancient Greek text.
Fermat and the copy of this book, which is a book about numbers with lots of problems, which presumably Fermat had to solve. He studied it, he wrote notes in the margins.
Fermat's original notes were lost, but they can still be read in a book published by his son. It was one of these notes that was Fermat's greatest legacy.
And this is the fantastic observation of Master Pierre de Fermat, which caused all the trouble. Cubam autem induas cubas.
This tiny note is the world's hardest mathematical problem. It's been unsolved for centuries. Yet it begins with an equation so simple that children know it by heart.
The square of the hypotenuse is the sum of the squares of the other two sides.
Yeah, well, that's Pythagoras' theorem, isn't it? That's what we all did at school. So, Pythagoras' theorem, the clever thing about it is that it tells us when three numbers are the sides of a rectangle triangle. That happens just when x squared plus y squared equals z squared.
X squared plus y squared equals z squared. And you can ask, well, what are the whole number solutions of this equation? Quickly find the solution. 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Another one is 5 squared plus 12 squared is 13 squared. And you go on looking and you find more and more. So then the natural question is, question Fermat raised, supposing you change from squares, supposing you replace the 2 by 3, by 4, by 5, by 6, by any whole number n. And Fermat said simply that you'll never find any solutions. However far you go, you'll never find a solution.
If n is greater than 2, we will never find numbers that fit this equation. That's what Fermat said. What's more, he said he could prove it. But instead, he scribbled a most enigmatic note.
Then he says he has a truly wonderful proof. Demonstrat theorem in Mirabilem of this fact. And then the last words are, Hank Marginis, executortis non caput. This margin is too small to contain it.
Just love it. Every time I see that show, I just have to say how much I love it. So, what's in Nova's future? Well, using that formula of storytelling, visuals, and characters, we will continue to strive to tell your stories with quality and distinction. And along with our loyal audience, Nova's greatest asset is our relationship with the scientific community. You give us your time and you lend us your credibility. And our job is to get the science right and to help you share your ideas with the public. It's a wonderful partnership. It's endured for many decades. And I'm very grateful to be here at this institute to continue that tradition. And I hope all of you will feel free to come to my office or to email me to let me know and to talk to me about what you do, because honestly, it's out of those conversations that great programs come. Thank you very much. Time, David, I'd be happy to take any questions. Right. Sure.
Okay. I have one question. Share with us, you talked about all your sponsors. I'd be very interested in, what it costs to put all of those on the average. Yeah. And the other question was, how the breakdown of the support comes. How much comes from corporations, viewers like me?
They cost an average about $500,000. Now that is really an average. There are some shows that we co-produce with other broadcasters, and for those perhaps we just pay half, $250,000. Occasionally we buy a science program, and that can cost about $100,000. But I have to tell you that our friends in the UK, the BBC, and Channel 4, because they've joined this race for ratings too, so they are actually making very few science programs now. So there are hardly any science programs on the market. We can actually buy one for $100,000 or $150,000, one or two a year. We're so happy we're overwhelmed. Now, some programs like The Fabric of the Cosmos, which you saw, which had about 500 animated shots in each of the five programs, that costs much, much, much more. And closely guarded secret exactly how much more. That program actually took that series took 7 years to make, 4 years to raise the money, and 3 years to actually make the films. So it's kind of all over the place. Our funding sources, it's now very difficult to get funds from corporations. I mean, you have to work very, very, very hard to get very, very little money. And now, whereas we've had funders who've been with us for 10 years, 12 years, Johnson & Johnson was with us for 14 years, now they want to come on for 3 months. So it's a kind of fluid and very unstable market. And honestly, I don't really do much. We have a department that does this. It's so few and far between. And so just these short flights that it's kind of not that much worth our while. We get a lot of money from foundations, the Sloan Foundation. I've been trying to get money from the Copley Foundation, knocking myself out for years and years, get money from them. We get money from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which is a wonderful funder. We also get money from government agencies, the NSF. The NSF actually put $250,000 into NOVA the first year. They've never funded NOVA as a series since then, but when we do special series like The Fabric of Cosmos, Making Stuff, NOVA Science Now, which is our magazine spinoff that I didn't really talk about here, then we can usually count on NSF to help us, although all of you who are NSF grantees know exactly what you have to go through to get an NSF grant. And the department that supports us in the president's current current budget has been cut by 22%, so for this year, so I don't know exactly what's going to happen. The Department of Energy now is coming on as a very good supporter for us, and they've really been very helpful. Occasionally we get money from NASA. The most fruitful area for us to go to now is individuals, and our major funder is David Koch, which, as you know, that's a very controversial name, but I have to say he's been a fantastic supporter of NOVA, and you know, many, many people accuse us of giving in to David Koch's supposed anti-climate change philosophy. David never talked to me about anything. He does not interfere at all, and I don't believe that he's anti-science at all. So we're very grateful to individuals who come to us, and I think that's probably the best area for us to go in the future. But as I'm sure this will resonate with a lot of you, it's getting harder and harder, really getting difficult. And the one thing, when I took the sabbatical, many of you know I still have to do some editorial work for NOVA, but the one area that I decided that I really needed a rest from was a fundraising, because you know, I have to spend much more of my time doing it than I really want. Yes.
Thank you. So I'm curious, with the interviews with the scientists, particularly when you have Neil deGrasse Tyson or David Koch hosting the program, how authentic, raw are those interviews, and how staged are they? Where in the continuum are they?
Well, David and Neil are both fantastic at talking to people and drawing them out. And so they are extremely genuine. And, you know, we tell them what we want in the scene. And, you know, we give them guidance before we go into the scene. We certainly track them as far as what the scientist does. And they study that. But they're both so good at it. Now, of course, we shoot probably 15-to-1 ratio. And there's especially David, who, you know, whose specialty is making these lame jokes. You know, he's always like, why are you leaving my great jokes on the floor? David, because, you know, there are a few great ones, but the rest are just kind of stupid. And they make a distinction between them. But those two happen to be really good. Brian, on the other hand, will not do that. He doesn't see himself as a journalist, and he doesn't want to play the journalist role. So you can see what we have, the Greek chorus that speaks. We do those interviews. So, you know, it depends. You have to have your style match what your host wants to do. Yeah.
What's your typical view of demographics like? I know what the view of demographics are, NPR and PBS.
Yeah.
Very wide, very educated, very urban, and very upper middle class. Is NOVA typical of that, or even one more very in front of that, those things?
Well, it's typical in that it's an older, fairly affluent, fairly well-educated audience. We are represented by every demographic group. It's people from all demographic groups. We are somewhat younger than the average PBS audience. We're more male skewed. Not greatly more, but we are more male skewed. But when we do a program, we did a program on genomic medicine at the end of Matt Marsh, and somehow the females found us because that was a female skewed. But when you have a female skewed program, you have fewer viewers. So
it's younger and a bit more male than typical PBS, otherwise.
And a bit more male. Now, one thing that our spinoff, our Nova Science Now spinoff, because it has stories that are 12 to 15 minutes long, it's getting more younger families with young children. So, you know, we love that when families watch our programs, which is why PBS decided that for the new Nova Science Now series in October and November, they would put it on at 10 o'clock. So, you know. I'm sorry, I'm telling you when I said that.
You also
mentioned that he uses it for schools use it for their classes. Is that then specially directed for that? And how do you get it available for them just like this? I mean, how do you?
It's not at all specially designed for that. And I mean, we make programs for general audience to watch on television or now online. What we try to do, because teachers nowadays don't have the time to assign a full 52-minute show. Used to be in the old days that they would, but they now, with all the science standards, etc., they just don't have time to do it. So we create clips for them that are 2, 3, 4 minute clips, and we actually have an essay with the clips and suggestions for how they can teach around it and how they can fit it into the curriculum and into science standards. And those are posted on PBS Learning Media, which is a fantastic online educational resource, and we also put them on our website.
I just had a question about online access. I happen to be in one of the Oregon Universe things, and I noticed that a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, PBS cut off the ability of internationals to watch their shows online. What was the reason for that?
All of our shows are geo-blocked abroad.
They used not to be.
Yeah, well, they are now
because when it was broadcast, you could watch it online for 3 or 4 years.
Our enterprises unit wants to sell the shows, and they feel that they can't if...
I tried to get it shown in my university class at the University of Toronto. Nova wanted an absolutely outrageous amount of money for it.
You want to,
I think that encourages educational
plans. You just call me.
I'm just saying.
I'll send you a DVD. I
found that kind of offensive.
You're talking to the wrong person. But this is how they feel. No, things have gotten very, as money shrinks, things get more nasty. That's the way it is. And we have lots of fights. Now they didn't want me to, they wanted to pull down Fabric of the Cosmos, the they being, you know, those nasty VPs. They wanted to pull down the Fabric of the Cosmos after 30 days, and I just went insane. Because we get money from the NSF, this is taxpayer, people should be able to see it. And while it's true that 50% of the views come probably in the first month and a half, that's 50, it has a long tail. The Elegant Universe still gets 1 million views a year, 9 years after its original broadcast. So I just wouldn't do it. But the geo-blocking, honestly, I just don't have the authority. I get so many emails from professors in China, just really kind of, but here's the thing. The BBC doesn't allow us to put their programs online at all. And we yell and scream, and sometimes we get a 50-day allowance. So, you know, there is, and in my opinion, my humble opinion, the question really is the extent to which having shows online prevents them from being sold as DVDs. I think they're two separate audiences. I really do. So I don't really think one impinges. And DVDs are that's a sunset technology. It's a pain in the neck, as anybody knows. I never watch anything on a DVD. If I can't download it again, I'm probably not going to watch it. So it's just too much of a pain. But we do get a lot of money from selling our shows abroad. So that's the rationale. I'm not defending it. Over here, yes.
Back a little bit to the technical side, I noticed that you have a focused science, then an intermission where you do something else. What's the ratio between science content versus all the around, surrounding, people walking, pictures moving? What's the ratio that you're shooting for in any of these clips?
You know, first of all, of course, clips are different from programs. And, you know, I pulled the best for you. I'm not going to pull boring stuff for you. I don't actually know the answer to your question. I think what I showed you, for example, in Smartest Machine on Earth, because I thought that was interesting. I first showed you the setup for the program, and then I showed you this machine learning was one of the big scientific issues. So I wanted to try to show you how we focus in on that. Obviously, we want and we try to have substantial science content in these programs. And I just have to say, it's a big, it's exactly what it is and how much it is. I call this talk The Art of Science Television. That's where the art comes in. You have to have room to have the narrator speak, because you're not going to be able to tell a story just with talking heads. So you have to have shots. We try now. Visuals are so important. Those of you who like to surf, you know you don't stop on a talking head, right? Probably not. Probably don't stop on someone walking across the screen with the screen. So we try to have as high a rate, as much content of great visuals and key visuals and what I call money shots as possible. So the actual science of the content, I've never figured it out. I've definitely done very different.
Is it done by instinct? I mean, it's fascinating. It's fascinating for whoever it teaches how you really balance it. So
I have to say I've never really thought about it in that kind of quantitative way. It is done by instinct. You know, we have a process, and our producers go out and they research, maybe 2 months worth of research, and some of you have been called and start out with telephone research, and then you travel to actually see people, and then along the way they'll write a 5-page kind of what's the story here for me. And at that point, you really try to hone in on what's the science story. We don't do shows that don't have a good science story. We just don't. So, and as I said, in some shows, you know, the Andrew Wiles show, The Proof, I do think that the producers there made a decision to kind of give up on the math and not put it front and center. In that case, you know, as I was watching, I hadn't seen it maybe 10 or 15 years. We were discussing this beforehand. And the night before I taught it in my class, I had asked the class to watch it, so I watched it myself. And I kind of re-engaged. There's something about that show that just, you know, I just love it. But I did lose the math. There's so many steps. I couldn't keep it in my head. There's no real mathematics in it, but I couldn't keep the logic in my head. And I said, forget it. If I had taken notes, perhaps. But you're not supposed to have to take notes.
You talked about 20 new shows a year, but 49
right.
Broadcasts are older shows then. We broadcast, after all, some of the science certainly remains of interest to audience.
Yes, they are. I mean, we have a lot of repeats, and that's just the way it is. We can only afford to make 20 shows. It's been that way for a long time. And you know, I think we all feel that, you know, that's no way to run a network. But I think that we would have a substantial taste among the audience for fewer repeats and more original shows. But until a few more David Cokes come around, we're not really going to be able to do that. The repeats, usually the first repeat out, they don't do quite as well as the original, but occasionally. Japan's Killer Quake, you know, you don't love that weather porn. And it was a good show. We turned it around actually within 16 days of the quake and tsunami. And it went out for the third time in February, and it did amazingly well. I think the Nielsen rating was almost the same as it was originally. Smartest Machine on Earth, which is really one of my favorite shows, that started out in the 10 o'clock slot. It's been on 3 times. This time it didn't do well. It, I'm sure, won't go on again for a long time.
So I'm a little bit interested in what criteria you use to judge yourself. Partly, of course, it seems to be Nielsen, right?
Partly it is.
And then feedback from scientists and so on.
The New York Times.
New York Times.
Yeah. So that's always good. But so much of what the Times writes is so stupid that I have really stopped caring that much about what they say. When we did a show, I don't know if any of you saw it, called The Spy Factory, which was by the National Security Agency. It got incredible access, and it was, we followed the research of a writer named James Bamford, and he looked at all of the clues that the NSA had for 9/11. And it was an amazing story. And Alexander Stanley wrote just an awful review of it. And so, like, after that, I'm over it. Now, I like and love Dennis Overdy. I'm sure you all know him. He's a physics writer for the Times, a wonderful writer, a genius, because he loved our series. So, you know, I have to say at this point, David, you know, I think, unfortunately, I think our network measures success more and more by ratings, and I think my big struggle is to really resist that, because at this point in my career, I don't want to be drawn into that. I really just don't want to be drawn into it. And because if we start going in that direction, as I said today, it's easy to make programs that get good ratings.
Have you ever tested whether it works educationally?
I can only tell educationally as far as schools go, or as far as the audience.
A focus group, an audience.
Yes.
And then you're asking the questions afterwards.
Yes. Every NSF supported show or DOE supported show has to be evaluated. Do you have to do evaluations in any of your things? So this is like the biggest racket in the world, evaluation. I want to go to heaven and be born again as an evaluator. So much money. So we try to make the evaluations more helpful to us. Occasionally we'll do what's called formative evaluations, and you have to have professionals do it for you, because it's like all gobbledygook and you don't really know what they're doing. But so we bring people in, and we actually did this informally with the Fabric of the Cosmos. We have great viewers. We just put out on our website, if you're in the Boston area, we really need your help. So the Fabric of the Cosmos was really, it was very, very, very difficult. And the Quantum Show of all of them was probably the hardest, I would say. And so we brought in people, and we give them pizza, and they watch a rough cut of the show, and you have to work very hard, because rough cuts are horrible, and you know, you hate them, because they're very rough. But, you know, we say, did you understand it? What did you get out of it? Did you want more science? Did you want less science? So when we're stymied, we do that. We bring people in. We ask them their opinion on titles. Titles are very important. Would you watch a show by this title? So, yes, I think, and a few years ago, we actually did a huge focus group. The Corporation of Public Broadcasting gave us a lot of money to do it. And I want to tell you that you haven't lived until you sit behind the screen, it's a two-way glass window, and you hear a bunch of people who've come in because they get $100 to come in and be part of a focus group for a night, trash your life's work. It is awful. It is an awful, terrible experience. And one woman said, "Nova makes me feel stupid." No, you don't really want that. They were extremely critical. We divided into three groups: Nova viewers, loyal viewers. Honestly, these people are wonderful. We can't do anything. Sorry, Dan. Sometimes viewers and never viewers. And of course, the never viewers were brutal. But you know, none of these people were dummies. And none of them were way out of our demographic. They're people in financial services, stuff like that. They're, you know, mathematically literate, they're in computers, et cetera. And so they say you record it, and after you get over the shock, you sit and you kind of have to open yourself to it and try to really get what they're saying. And it was really a difficult, probably the most difficult process that I've had in this job in a long time. And we actually made a lot of changes as a result of it. And my goal is always change style, don't change substance. And I think as long as we can get away with that, see, I think, and you know, I have a lot of trash talking with my colleagues at Discovery and National Geographic, and they've changed their substance, they've changed their content. Style is fine to change. And people want things faster. It's an impatient world now. There's nothing wrong with doing it. There's no justification for having pokey shows. And so you have to change style to contemporize what you do. But to try not to change substance, to try not to change the level of the science, to dumb it down, that's our goal.
Okay, on that very high note, let's thank Paul again. She'll hold a special test, which will be, in fact, a focus group, right?
Yeah, I
know. On an ongoing program. We can all help you prove a little loyal. I'll let you know when.
Yes, I'll let you know. Thank you.